absolute positivity that I am soon going to be Mrs. Daniel Attaché to the Ambassador Dupré. Even Axelrot will be high and dry with no one but the maid to pick up his socks, and Daniel, bless his heart, will never even know what hit him. Leah Price Ngemba, Bikoki Station, January 17, 1965. It can feel cold here in the early morning haze of the dry season. Or maybe it's just me. Maybe my blood's gotten thin, a weakness Father used to accuse us of when we complained of the chill winters in North Georgia. Certainly there's no winter here. The equator just about runs smack dab through our bed. Anatole tells me I'm passing from the northern to the southern hemisphere whenever I go out to poke up the fire in the kitchen house, so I should consider myself worldly, even though it's nearly impossible these days to leave the station. The plain, bitter truth is that this day chills me to the bone. I try not to pay attention to the month and date, but the blossoming poinsettias roar at me that it's coming anyway, and on January 17th I'll wake up too early with an ache in my chest. Why did I have to crow, "Who's brave enough to go out there with me?" Knowing her as I did, that she'd never stand to be called a coward by anyone, least of all her sister. It's a bleak anniversary in our household. I killed a snake this morning, just whacked it into pieces with my machete and flung all three of them up in the trees. It was the big black one that's been hanging around the back door since the end of the rains. Anatole came out and clucked his tongue at my handiwork. That snake was not doing us any harm, Beany. I'm sorry, but I woke up this morning craving an eye for an eye. What does this mean? It means that snake crossed my path on the wrong day. He was eating a lot of rats. Now they will be into your manioc. Black rats or white ones, I'm not sure I can tell the difference. He looked at me a long time, trying to work me out. Finally he asked, "Why do you think your sadness is so special? Children died every day in Kilanga. They are dying here and now." "Oh, how could I forget, Anatole? She was just one of a million people who left the world that day, along with the great Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. I'm sure in the long run Ruth May hardly mattered at all." He came to me and touched my hair, which has gotten rather shaggy. When I can remember to be a good Congolese wife, I tie it up in a headcloth. Anatole carefully wiped my eyes with the tail of his shirt. "Do you think I can't remember, little sister? She had the heart of a mongoose, brave and clever. She was the chief of all children in Kilanga, including her big sisters. Don't talk about her. Just go to work. Wenda Mbote." I took his hand away and glared at him. "Don't mention her, and I won't speak of your Lumumba shattered with machetes like this poor snake and thrown in pieces into an abandoned house in Elizabethville with the blessings of my hateful homeland." I stomped off to the kitchen house where I could hear the rats already in the manioc, rewarding my spite. This is a day Anatole and I simply have to get through. I've heard people say grief brings you closer, but the griefs he and I carry are so different. Mine are white, no doubt, and American. I hold on to Ruth May, while he and the rest of the Congo secretly hold a national day of mourning for lost independence. I can recall years ago watching Rachel cry real tears over a burn hole in her green dress, while just outside our door completely naked children withered from the holes burning in their empty stomachs, and I seriously wondered if Rachel's heart were the size of a thimble. I suppose that's how he sees me today. Any other day I might pray, like my old friends the Benedictine sisters, to lose my self-will in the service of greater glory. But January 17th in my selfish heart is Ruth May's only. Through a crack between the boards, I watched him pick up his book bag and head off in his earnest, square-shouldered Anatole way down the road toward the school. Anatole, my first prayer to creation, answered. Both of us were spared, in body at least, by the stone walls of our different imprisonments, and altered in spirit in ways we're struggling to understand. I've lost all the words to my childhood prayers, so my head rings with its own grand silence, and Anatole has found new words for shaping belief. His circumstances were as bizarre as mine, and very lucky. We agree on that. Most dissidents now are executed or held under conditions that make them wish for execution. But Mobutu was just getting organized in 61 and still given to peculiar omissions. Anatole got to spend his days playing bottle-cap checkers with a pair of lackadaisical guards who let him read and write anything as long as he didn't escape. They liked Anatole and apologized that they had to support their families on the handful of coins or rice they got when Mobutu's deputies came by to count the prisoners each morning. After that, he could organize lessons under the courtyard's scabby mango, teaching literacy to any guard or fellow prisoner who felt like improving himself on a given day. The guards helped get books for Anatole and went to a lot of trouble to get his letters posted to various countries. Right under Mobutu's nose, he discovered the writings of the great African nationalist Kwame Nkrumah and the poetry of a young doctor in Angola, Agostinho Neto, with whom he started up a correspondence. Neto is about Anatole's age, also educated by missionaries. He'd already gone abroad to study medicine and returned home to open a clinic where his own people could get decent care, but it didn't work out. A gang of white policemen dragged him out of his clinic one day, beat him half to death, and carted him off to prison. The crowds that turned up to demand his release got cut down like trees by machine gun fire. Not only that, but the Portuguese army went out burning villages to the ground to put a damper on Neto's popularity. Yet the minute he got out of prison, he started attracting droves of people to an opposition party in Angola. Anatole is encouraged by his example and talks about Neto a good deal, hoping to meet with him somehow, somewhere. I can't feature it when it's too dangerous now for them even to continue writing letters. Of course, Anatole's most faithful prison correspondence was with a nun in Bangassou, which was a matter of great hilarity to his fellow prisoners. Sa planche de salut, they teased, his long plank to salvation, a slang expression meaning your last hope. Anatole still sometimes calls me his planche de salut. But by the time we were reunited last fall, I was unsure enough of God and too mad at everybody else to offer any kind of salvation. For sure, though, I'd had enough of poverty, chastity, obedience to trade it in on being Anatole's wife. A medical evacuation jeep got me through disguised as a corpse all the way to Bikoki, an old rubber plantation settlement outside of Coquiatville. My sweetheart, released after 3 years without formal charges, was waiting here to raise the dead. We chose Bikoki, expecting to find people Anatole knew here, former friends and employers in the rubber trade, but most are dead now or have left the country. A surprise, though, was Aunt Elizabeth, his mother's youngest sister. She came looking for him here a decade ago. Anatole was already gone long before, but Elizabeth took work at the mission station, had a child, and never left. It's a great change for Anatole to have relatives and a wife after his lifelong status as an orphan. The mission is a ghost town now, and the agricultural station also nearly deserted. The Simbas have cleared the place of Europeans without ever setting foot here. The plantation is mostly rubble. I imagine it dismantled by the whacked-off ghost hands of all those rubber workers. The one building left standing contains the very library where Anatole, as a young household servant, taught himself to read and write English. At my request, we were married in that room by the village chief in a ceremony that was neither quite Christian nor Bantu. I asked for God's blessing and carried red bougainvillea flowers for my mother. Aunt Elizabeth draped around our shoulders the traditional marriage cloth called nzole, a beautiful double-sized panier that symbolizes the togetherness of marriage. It also works as a bedspread. Since its heyday as a planter's mansion, parts of the house had been used as an army bunker, a birthing hospital, and a goat barn. Now the plan was to use it for a school. The department chief in Coquiatville admires Anatole, so turned a blind eye to his prison record and hired him as headmaster for the regional École Secondaire. We're also trying to keep open the agricultural extension program, training former rubber workers to subsistence farming. And I volunteer at the clinic where a Guinean doctor comes once a week from Coquiatville to immunize and diagnose babies. In spite of all we'd been through, Anatole and I stood together last fall and declared the word independence out loud. We'd said it with our eyes on the sky as if it were some fabulous bird we could call down out of the air. It's taken a lot to dampen our hopes. But everything has turned around so fast, like a magician's trick. Foreign hands moved behind the curtain, and one white king was replaced with another. Only the face that shows is black. Mobutu's U.S. advisors even tried to hold elections here, but then got furious when the wrong person won, Antoine Gizenga, Lumumba's lieutenant. So they marched the army into parliament and reorganized it once again in Mobutu's favor. If the Americans mean to teach us about democracy, the lesson is quite remarkable, Anatole observed. Breathtaking, I agreed. He says I have different personalities, that my Lingala is sweet and maternal, but in English I'm sarcastic. I told him that's nothing, in French I'm a minesweeper. Which personality annoys you the most? He kissed my forehead. The most, I love my Bayene. His absolute truth. Is that what I am? When the neighbors or students ask me my nationality, I tell them I came from a country that no longer exists. They can believe it. In the last months, our government paychecks have dwindled from almost nothing to nothing. We tell our co-workers that a mere lack of funds mustn't discourage our hopes. We know that to criticize Mobutu, even in private, is to risk having your head cracked open like a nut, which naturally would discourage one's hopes entirely. We live on what we can find, and when we're offered news of friends, we take a deep breath first. My old friend Pascal and two other former students of Anatole's were murdered by the army on the road south of here. Pascal had a kilo of sugarcane and a defunct World War II handgun in his backpack. We heard about it on Christmas Day when we had a visit from Fenton and Celine Fowles. They're now staying in Kikongo, the hospital mission on the Wamba that they told us about. I rejoiced to see them, but any reunion brings awful news, and I cried myself to sleep when they left. I'd nearly forgotten Pascal, his wide-set eyes and insolent smile, and now he comes creeping around my dreams, throwing open windows faster than I can shut them. What little scrap of audacity caught the attention of an army officer on the road? What if I marked him with some English word I taught him as stupidly as we doomed our parrot? This is the kind of crazy dread we live with. Our neighbors are equally terrified of Mobutu's soldiers and their opposition, the Simbas, whose reputation is stalking northern Congo like a lion itself. The Simbas' anger against all foreigners is understandable, but increasingly their actions aren't. We hear of atrocities on the shortwave, then hear them exaggerated on Mobutu's official newscasts, and it's hard to know what's real. I think about food mostly and occupy my mind by watching children. I don't really fear the Simbas, even though I'm white. Anatole is very well respected. My alliance with him will save me, or it won't. Justice moves in mysterious ways. Father is still carrying on with his tormented Jesus is Bangala church. This was the Fowles' other awful news. Father had walked or hitchhiked all the way over to the Kikongo mission in an agitated state, bellowing that his guts were on fire with venom. He claimed he'd swallowed a live snake. The mission doctor gave him quinine and vermifuges, which would give pinworms a run for their money, but likely not a green mamba. Poor father. Now he's left Kilanga altogether, vanished into the forest, it seems, or melted under the rain. Sometimes at night, I think about how he might be dead, and I haven't heard yet. It's a hard thing to live with in the dark, and I lie awake cooking up plans to go hunt for him. But in daylight, a wall of anger pushes me in a different direction, roaring that I must leave father behind me. I couldn't strike out on my own, and even with help, it's not worth the risk. I understand that he's dangerous to me now. Dangerous to many people, and always was, I guess. Fenton and Celine must have been alarmed by our misguided outpost in Kilanga, where we slept in their same house, antagonized their former friends, even turned their parrot out to nature's maw. And that mission doctor at Kikongo must have found father a sight to behold, a wild-haired preacher with a snake in his belly. That doctor has stayed on with his family in spite of the danger. They're from some place in the South, Fenton thought, Georgia or Kentucky. I wish I could go visit them and talk in my own language, the English I knew before I grew thorns on my tongue. It's the only time I get homesick when America lands on my doorstep in a missionary guise. There are others who didn't go back, like me, but they seem so sure of being right here where they are, so rooted by faith, Fenton Fowles for one, and the strangers who turn up ever so often to ask if I can help get a message through or keep a box of medicine safe till a boat is found to take it upriver. I'll happily invent a meal and make up a bed on the floor just to hear the kindness in their stories. They're so unlike father. As I bear the emptiness of a life without his God, it's a comfort to know these soft-spoken men who organize hospitals under thatched roofs, or stoop alongside village mamas to plant soybeans, or rig up electrical generators for a school. They've risked Mobutu and every imaginable parasite in the backwater places where children were left to die or endure when the underdowns and their ilk fled the country. As Brother Fowles told us a long time ago, there are Christians and there are Christians. But visitors of any stripe are rare, and most days are exactly like the ones before. Funny to speak of boredom, I guess. If I'd tried in childhood to imagine my present life in the jungle, I'd have been struck numb with the adventure of it. But instead, I'm numb with the tedium of a hard life. We collapse into bed at night. I spend all day walking between the soybean fields, the kitchen house, the market, the clinic, and the nutrition class I teach at the agriculture school, wondering on a given day if I've given out more information than I've taken in. For sure, that's the direction the calorie count is going. We have manioc and yams to fill our bellies, but protein is scarcer than diamonds. I bargain high and low for an egg or beans, a precious chicken, some fresh river fish, or I'll catch a ride into the Kokiakville market to gaze at such treasures as tinned ham for a king's ransom. Sometimes I even manage to pay for it. But Anatole has lost weight this winter, and I've lost even more, 8 kilos. So fast I'm a little scared. Probably I have whipworm again. I'm pretty sure I was pregnant at Christmas time, but now I'm sure I'm not, so there must have been a loss in there. But it's easier not to mention it to Anatole. Easier not to count it, if that's possible. I'm losing my family, piece by piece. Father is lost wherever he is. Rachel, I could only despise more if I knew for sure which way to direct my ire. Presumably South Africa, where I guess she's finally hit pay dirt with her exceeding whiteness and mercenary husband. I can't reliably get a letter to Mother or Ada. Mobutu's chief postal minister, a relative of Mobutu's wife, stopped paying all the postal workers for the last year so he could use the money to build himself a mansion in Teesville. Now it takes a huge bribe or a personal contact to get mail out of the country, and the letters incoming, I can only suppose, are piling up somewhere in Leopoldville, being sniffed for money or valuables. If people are shocked by these unexplained losses, the post, their salary, a friend walking home on the road, they don't mention it. What do people here know but forbearance? They take one look at the expensive foreign-made uniforms of Mobutu's police and know to keep their thoughts to themselves. They know who stands behind Mobutu and that in some place as far away as heaven, where the largest rules are made, white and black lives are different kinds of currencies. When 30 foreigners were killed in Stanleyville, each one was tied somehow to a solid exchange, a gold standard like the hard Belgian franc. But a Congolese life is like the useless Congolese bill, which you can pile by the fistful or the bucketful into a merchant's hand and still not purchase a single banana. It's dawning on me that I live among men and women who've simply always understood their whole existence is worth less than a banana to most white people. I see it in their eyes when they glance up at me. January is a hard, dry month, and I'm lonely, I think. Lonely for others of my kind, whoever that might be. Sometimes I imagine leaving, going home to see Mother and Ada at least, but the logistics of money and travel and a passport are too laborious even to imagine. My daydream gets as far as the front gate and ends right there, looking back at Anatole, who's saying, "Not you, Beene." Tonight he'll come home worried and exhausted. There's hardly any way to keep the École Secondaire open another term without funds, and parents are anxious that education is only putting their children at greater risk. The awful truth is, they're right. But he won't talk about that. He'll sneak up behind me in the kitchen house and throw an arm across my chest, making me scream and laugh at the same time. He'll rub his knuckles into my hair and cry, "Wife, your face is as long as a crocodile's." I'll tell him it's just as ugly, too, and my skin is about that scaly. I say these things so he'll argue with me. I'm difficult in January. I know this. I need him to insist that I'm useful and good, that he wasn't out of his mind to marry me, that my white skin is not the standard of offense, that I wasn't part of every mistake that's led us to right now, January 17th, with all its sins and griefs to bear. He reminded me once that the first Green Mamba was meant for him. He aroused Tata Kuvadundu's anger by encouraging discussion about us and white people in general. He blames his misjudgment of village politics. We all have that snake in our belly, I suppose, but Anatole can't take mine. If I can't yet mourn 1 million people who left this world in a single day, I'll start with one and move from there. I don't have much left of my childhood beliefs I can love or trust, but I still know what justice is. As long as I'm carrying Ruth May piggyback through my days with her voice in my ear, I still have her with me. Ada Price, Emory Hospital, Atlanta, Christmas, 1968. I am losing my slant. In medical school, I have been befriended by an upstart neurologist who believes I am acting out a great lifelong falsehood, Ada's falsehood. In his opinion, an injury to the brain occurring as early as mine should have no lasting effects on physical mobility. He insists there should have been complete compensation in the undamaged part of my cerebral cortex, and that my dragging right side is merely holding on to a habit it learned in infancy. I scoffed at him, of course. I was unprepared to accept that my whole sense of Ada was founded on a misunderstanding between my body and my brain. But the neurologist was persuasive, intimidatingly handsome, and the recipient of a fabulously coveted research grant. Mostly to prove him wrong, I submitted my body to an experimental program of his design. For 6 months, he had me stop walking entirely in order to clear my nervous pathways of so-called bad habits. Instead, I crawled. With the help of friends, I rearranged my small apartment to accommodate a grown-up baby and warily crept each morning from a mattress to my coffee maker and hot plate on the kitchen floor. I used only the lower half of the refrigerator. To preserve my dignity, I went to work in a wheelchair. I was starting a rotation in pediatrics at the time, good luck, since children don't tend to hold the crippled responsible for their infirmities as grown-ups do. Adults listen to you with half an ear, while the biblical prescription, physician, heal thyself, rings in the other. But children, I found, were universally delighted by a doctor with wheels. At home, while I set about memorizing the flaws in my carpet, my body learned to cross-coordinate. One day I felt the snap like a rubber band that drew my right leg up under me as my left arm moved forward. A week later, I found I could easily balance on my hands and toes, push my rear end up into the air, and fall over into a sit. Nobody was there to watch, praise be, as I spontaneously clapped my hands at the wonder of my accomplishment. Within a few weeks, I had strength enough in both arms to pull myself up on the furniture, and from there I could release myself to a stand. Now, tentatively, I toddle in a straight line. I have taken each step in its turn. I was not learning it all over again, but for the first time, apparently, since Mother claims I did none of these things as a baby. She insists I lay on my back for 3 years crying for Leah to stay close and play with me, until finally one day, without prelude, I rolled off the couch and limped after her. Mother says I never practiced anything but always watched Leah, letting her make the mistakes for both of us until I was ready to do it myself with acceptable precision. Mother is kind to me, probably because I've stayed nearer at hand than her other children. But I disagree. I made plenty of my own mistakes. I just made them on the inside. It has taken me so long to believe I am saved. Not from crookedness. I am still to some extent crooked and always too slow. But saved from the abandonment I deserved. It has taken until tonight, in fact. Leah is in Atlanta now, and that is part of the problem, if not the whole of it. Leah with Anatole and their little son Pascal and another child well in progress. Leah majoring in agronomics and all of them making a noble attempt to plant themselves on American soil. I can see it will not last. When I go with them to the grocery, they are boggled and frightened and secretly scornful, I think. Of course they are. I remember how it was at first, dazzling warehouses buzzing with light, where entire shelves boast nothing but hairspray, tooth-whitening cream, and foot powders. It is as if our Rachel had been left suddenly in charge of everything. "What is that, Aunt Ada, and that?" their Pascal asks in his wide-eyed way, pointing through the aisles. A pink jar of cream for removing hair, a can of fragrance to spray on the carpet, stacks of lidded containers the same size as the jars we throw away each day. They're things a person doesn't really need. But, Aunt Ada, how can there be so many kinds of things a person doesn't really need? I can think of no honorable answer. Why must some of us deliberate between brands of toothpaste, while others deliberate between damp dirt and bone dust to quiet the fire of an empty stomach lining? There is nothing about the United States I can really explain to this child of another world. We leave that to Anatole, for he sees it all clearly in an instant. He laughs aloud at the nearly naked women on giant billboards and befriends the bums who inhabit the street corners of Atlanta, asking them detailed questions about where they sleep and how they kill their food. The answers are interesting. You might be surprised to know how many pigeons roosting in the eaves of Atlanta's public library have ended up roasting over fires in Grant Park. I find an extraordinary kindred spirit in Anatole. We are both marked, I suppose, freaks at first sight who have learned to take the world at face value. He was marked early on by his orphaned state, his displacement, his zealous, skeptical mind, his aloneness. I have noticed that he, too, reads things backward, what the billboards are really selling, for example. Also, where poverty comes from and where it goes. I shall not covet my sister's husband, but I shall know him in my way better. Anatole and I inhabit the same atmosphere of solitude. The difference between us is he would give up his right arm and leg for Leah, whereas I already did. Will I lose myself entirely if I lose my limp? How can I reasonably survive beyond the death of Ruth May and all those children? Will salvation be the death of me? Here in the hospital, I have too much time for questions like these. It occurs to me I have access to an infinite variety of narcotic drugs. Sleep is an absolute possibility. God can't see you when you're asleep, Ruth May used to insist. Evil peels no eye on sleep. Live. Die. They see a great deal of Mother. Mother last year gave up her floral hermitage in Bethlehem and moved to an apartment in Atlanta, having found a new church of sorts. She marches for civil rights. They pay her to work in an office, but I know she lives for the marches. She is very good at it and impervious to danger. She came over to my apartment one night, having walked nearly a mile through tear gas so that I could check her eyes for damage to the cornea. Her eyes were not even red. I think bullets would pass right through her. It crosses my mind that I may need a religion. Although Mother has one now, and she still suffers. I believe she talks to Ruth May more or less constantly, begging forgiveness when no one is around. Leah has one. Her religion is the suffering. Rachel doesn't, and she is plainly the happiest of us all, though it could be argued that she is herself her own brand of goddess. I am sorry to say I do not see Leah and Anatole as much as I might. Being a medical student, of course, I have an inhuman schedule, and everyone makes allowances for that. Also, I am in a different region of the university altogether from married student housing. They are making babies over there, while over here we merely save them. It has been a difficult month, a rotation in neonatal intensive care. We lost two babies in the last week, and in this past day, Christmas Eve, while the clock made two complete rotations of its own, I watched over three tiny creatures whose lungs struggled like the flat, useless wings of butterflies prematurely emerged. Triplets. I considered Nelson's view of what ought to be done with twins, and the dreadful consequences of ignoring that tradition. What we had here was worse, a triple calamity fallen on the house of these poor parents. I spoke with the father, a boy of 16 or so, who gave the clear impression through the use of the conditional tense when speaking of the parental care required for these damaged children that he might not stick around. So, a plague on the mother alone. While the machines hummed softly in our hospital and white-soled shoes whispered up and down the halls, a catastrophe was roaring down upon this child of a mother. This is her Christmas gift. She will be indentured forever. Never again will her life be free of travail and disappointment in her three blind mice. She may cut off their tails with a carving knife, this husbandless wife, whose school friends are still promenading through their girlhoods. Who is to say she should not have run to the forest with her hair and umbilical cords flying and knelt to deposit each of these three at the base of its own pine tree? Who will argue that my drips and incubators are really the wiser plan? Who could blame Mother if she had chosen to leave me so? After midnight, I fell asleep on my cot in the intern's lounge, but was battered by dreams. Entubed, damaged children of all colors danced on my head and arms and hands. Live or die, they chorused. Mother, may we? Africa has slipped the floor out from under my righteous house, my Ada moral code. How sure I always felt before, how smug, moving through a world that desired to cast me into the den of ear-pulling crawlies. Ada, the bridled, entitled. Ada, authorized to despise one and all. Now she must concede to those who think perhaps I should have been abandoned in the jungle at birth. Well, they have a point. What I carried out of Congo on my crooked little back is a ferocious uncertainty about the worth of a life. And now I am becoming a doctor. How very sensible of me. I struggled half awake and half asleep, and then suddenly, in the middle of my fevered, stolen nap, utterly awake, in dread, trembling, lying on my side with my eyes open. I felt my cold hands. I was afraid. This is the new awful thing I cannot bear to feel. Afraid. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. In spite of myself, I have loved the world a little, and may lose it. I sat up on my cot, ran a hand through my damp, tangled hair, felt bruises all over my arms in the shape of small footprints. The second hand on the wall clock made its steady, ludicrous progress. Slough, slough, slough. Afraid of what, exactly? Suicidal, idle, fratricidal. Afraid that... Mother would choose Leah. Perfect, Leah, with her adorable babe and husband. In a few hours it will be morning. They will dance around the tree with their little gifts from Mother, and they will stay. They will, after all. And the lure of grandsons will be too strong to resist, and Mother will be theirs. And then I will have to go to sleep. Sleep, O sleep, thou certain knot of peace. For many tedious seconds I sat on the edge of my cot, swallowing indecision and tears. Then I got up, wiped my face on the sleeve of my hospital coat, walked to the physician's lounge, and dialed the number I knew by heart. I called her. It was the dead-flat middle of the night before Christmas, and all through the house I am Ada, who expects no gifts, Ada who does not need or care what others say. Yet I woke up my mother and finally asked her why she chose me that day at the Quingue River. Mother hesitated, understanding that there were many wrong answers. I did not want to hear that the others could take care of themselves, nor that she felt she had no other choice. Finally, she said, "After Ruth May, you were my youngest, Ada. When push comes to shove, a mother takes care of her children from the bottom up." That is the bedtime story my mother made up for me. It was not a question of my own worth at all. There is no worth. It was a question of position and a mother's need. After Ruth May, she needs me most. I find this remarkably comforting. I have decided to live with it. Leah Price Ngemba, Kinshasa, 1974. You can't go to Leopoldville now, or to Stanleyville, Kokiatville, or Elizabethville. The names of all those conquerors and their ladies have been erased from our map. For that matter, you can't even go to the Congo. It's Zaire. We repeat these words as if we're trying to memorize a false identity. I live in Kinshasa, Zaire. The places we've always used to position ourselves are suddenly unfamiliar. Cities, villages, even rivers. Elizabeth worries genuinely, in spite of our reassurances, that she and Anatole might have been assigned new first names, since theirs are European and colonialist. It wouldn't surprise me, actually. Mobutu's edicts are that far-reaching. The old couple next door seem to share her dread. They always forget and say Leopoldville, then cover their mouths with their hands as if they've let slip a treason. In the evenings, we quiz each other, searching out more and more obscure places on the map to trip each other up. Charlesville, Banningville, Jokapunda, Bandundu. The boys get them right more often than I do, mainly because they like to show off. Anatole never misses one because his mind is that quick, and also I think the indigenous names mean more to him. They're foreign to me, of course. After the boys are asleep, I sit at the table in the flickering kerosene light, working my way slowly over the new map, feeling as if Father had found me out here to give me the verse. We're retraining our tongues to Mobutu's great campaign of authenticité. But what is authentic about it, I keep asking Anatole. Kinshasa's main street is Boulevard, the 30th of June, in memory of that great Independence Day carefully purchased by thousands of pebbles thrown into bowls and carried upriver. How authentic is that? What really became of that vote is another matter not memorialized in any public place I can see. There is no Boulevard 17 Janvier Mort de Lumumba. He points to the dirt path that runs between ours and our neighbors' houses, down through a ditch where we clutch up our skirts and tiptoe over the sewage on oil drums to reach the main road. This boulevard needs a name, Bene. Put a sign here. Wise guy. He can't wait to see if I'll do it. Our house is sturdy with a concrete floor and a tin roof. We live in what would be called in America a slum, though here it's an island of relative luxury in the outskirts of La Cité, where the majority have a good deal less in the way of roofing, to say the least. Under our roof, we're six. Anatole and me, our boys Pascal, Patrice, and the baby Martin Lothaire, and Aunt Elizabeth, plus her daughter Christiane occasionally. After we came back from Atlanta, we brought Elizabeth down here from Bikoki, where things had gotten fairly desperate. I can't say they're any less desperate here, but she's good company. I thought I'd learned resourcefulness, but Elizabeth has given me a higher education in making soup out of stones. Mondele, she calls me. I'm her white daughter. Yet she's hardly older than Anatole and looks just like him, minus the broad shoulders and narrow waist. Her shape is somewhat the reverse. With his same sweet patience, she works non-stop in our one-room house, singing in Lingala, her left hand always holding her outer panier closed for modesty, while her right does more alone than I could with three. She's told me everything she can recall of her older sister, Anatole's mother, and like a kid I make her repeat the stories. I'm hungry for any family I can get. I'm lucky if I hear from Mother and Ada twice a year. It's not their fault. I know they've sent countless packages that are piled up somewhere in the great crumbling postal edifice downtown. I expect the Minister of Post could build himself a second or third home out of undelivered boxes. By some miracle, we did get a package at Easter time. The boys hooted and ran the length of our 17 Janvier lane, brandishing their precious Mars bars, which I heard Pascal boast to his friends are manufactured on Mars. I was tempted to do the same with my own loot, 5 books in English. Also, clothing, aspirin, antibiotics, hand lotion, thick cotton diapers, batteries for our radio, and long letters. I buried my face in the clothes for the scent of my mother, but of course they came from some American child who's no kin to us. Mother does volunteer work in African relief. We're her pet project, you could say. In every package, there's one oddball thing from Ada, a sort of secret message is how I think of it. This time, it was an old Saturday evening post she'd found in the bottom of Mother's closet. I leafed through it, wondering, did Ada want me to read about how Jimmy Stewart got his start, or to know that when a Philco moves in, your TV troubles move out? Then I found it, an article called "Will Africa Go Communist?" Ada retains her eagle eye for irony. It was all about how the U.S. ought to take better charge of the maverick Congo. The 2 photographs stopped my heart. In one, a young Joseph Mobutu looks out imploringly above a caption declaring his position in jeopardy. Next to him is a smiling, rather crafty-looking Patrice Lumumba with a caption warning, "He may be on his way back." The magazine is dated February 18, 1961. Lumumba was already a month dead, his body buried under a chicken coop in Shaba, and Mobutu already well assured of his throne. I can picture the Georgia housewife shuddering at the communist challenge, quickly turning the page on that black devil Lumumba with the pointed chin. But I was hardly any less in the dark, and I was in Bulungu, the very village where Lumumba had been captured. My sister married a man who may have assisted in his death sentence transport to Shaba, though even Rachel will never know that for sure. We have in this story the ignorant, but no real innocence. Ada wrote at the bottom of the page, "Remember Devil One and W.I. Rogue, our secret secrets?" She says there's talk now of an investigation that the Congress may look into past wrongdoing in the Congo or any possible link between the CIA, Lumumba's death, and the army coup that brought Mobutu to power. Are they joking? Ada says no one is giving it any credence. Here, no one has ever doubted it. It's as if history can be no more than a mirror tipped up to show each of us exactly what we already knew. Now everyone's pretending to set the record straight. They'll have their hearings while Mobutu makes a show of changing all European-sounding place names to indigenous ones to rid us of the sound of foreign domination. And what will change? He'll go on falling over his feet to make deals with the Americans, who still control all our cobalt and diamond mines. In return, every grant of foreign aid goes straight to Mobutu himself. We read he's building himself an actual castle with spires and a moat near Brussels, to provide a respite, I guess, from his villas in Paris and Spain and Italy. When I open my door and look out, I see a 1,000 little plank and cardboard houses floating at every conceivable tilt on an endless ocean of dust. We hardly have a functional hospital in our borders or a passable road outside Kinshasa. How can this be, a castle with spires and a moat? Why doesn't the world just open its jaws like a whale and swallow this brazenness in one gulp, is the question I'd pose to Father these days. Who gave him charge of the whole world? If you have insight, hear this. Can one who hates right govern? Job 34:13. Thank you very much. The latest news from Mobutu is that he's bringing 2 great American boxers, Muhammad Ali and George Foreman, to the stadium in Kinshasa. The announcement came on the radio this afternoon. I only listened with one ear because of a larger drama unfolding in our kitchen. I'd just put Martin down for a nap on his mat and was boiling the diapers while Elizabeth crumbled a papery onion and hot pili pili into a bowl. She fries this with mashed tomatoes into a thin red sauce for the manioc. That's the principal trick of Congolese cooking, rubbing 2 leaves together to give color and taste to another day's translucent, nutritionally blank ball of manioc. The pot for boiling the fufu was waiting in line for the stove after the diapers, and after that would come the big laundry kettle with the boys' shirts and our household's 3 sheets and 2 towels. Here in Kinshasa, we have a city kitchen with a stove right inside the house, but it's only a little bottle gas burner, maddeningly sluggish after my years of cooking over roaring wood fires. A lot of people in La Cité do cook with wood, which they have to nibble secretively from each other's houses at night like termites. This was supposed to be a payday for Anatole, and at the school there's been talk about the supplementaire, meaning the possibility of the government starting back payments on the wages they'd been stealing from all public schools for over a year. This supplement is supposed to be a sign of good faith, to forestall a nationwide strike of university students, but some students walked out anyway, and the signs of Mobutu's faith so far have been expressed with nightsticks. I worry constantly about Anatole, although I know his capacity for self-restraint in a dangerous moment is uncanny. Elizabeth and I knew there would be no supplementaire, but we're still greatly enjoying spending it at tomorrow's market. A kilo of fresh eels and 2 dozen eggs, I proposed, and she laughed at me. My craving for protein drives me to a single-mindedness she calls my mondele hungries. Better 10 kilos of rice and 2 bars of soap, she said, which we do need badly, but I despaired for an imaginary windfall that would bring nothing but more white starch into this house. Nothing white, I declared. Brown soap, then, she offered. Oh, and some nice pink papier hygiénique, she added fervently, and we both laughed at that pipe dream. The last roll of toilet paper we'd seen, in any color, came from Atlanta. At least some beans, Elizabeth, I whined. Fresh green ones. Mangwansi, like we used to have in the country. Pascal's best friend, a hearty girl named Elevé, had wandered in and sat down at the table opposite Elizabeth, but was uncharacteristically quiet. What do you think? Elizabeth prodded her with the blunt end of her knife. Tell Madame Ngimba she needs a new panier with some color left in it. Tell her she is disgracing her sons with the washing rag she wears to the market. Elevé picked at the short sleeve of her school uniform, evidently not desiring to talk about fashion. Her very black skin looked ashy, and she had the tired slump to her shoulders I recognize in my boys when they're getting hookworm. I carried the boiled diapers outside, washed my hands carefully with our sliver of soap, and interrupted the afternoon's procession of cookpots to make Elevé a cup of tea. Suddenly she reported with a blank face that she was leaving school. "Oh, Elevé, you can't," I said. She's a smart little girl, though this guarantees nothing, of course. Elizabeth simply asked her, why? To work at night with mother, she said flatly, meaning to work as a prostitute. How old are you? I demanded angrily. 11? 10? This is a crime, Elevé. You're a child. There are laws to protect you from that kind of work. It's horrible. You don't know. You'll be scared and hurt and could get terribly sick. Elizabeth looked at me with dismay. Mondele, don't frighten her. They have to have the money. Of course that's true. And of course there are no laws to protect children from prostitution. Elizabeth's daughter, Christiane, I'd guess to be 17, and I suspect she sometimes does night work in town, though we can't talk about it. Whenever we hit rock bottom, Elizabeth somehow discovers a little cash in her purse. I wish she wouldn't. I just stared at Elevé, my son's little friend with skinned knees and her 2 braids sticking out like handlebars. A prostitute. It dawned on me that her childishness would increase her value for a while, anyway. That made me want to scream. I shoved the manioc pot onto the stove, slopping water all over everywhere. I survive here on outrage. Naturally, I would. I grew up with my teeth clamped on a faith in the big white man in power. God, the president, I don't care who he is, he'd serve justice. Whereas no one here has ever had the faintest cause for such delusions. Sometimes I feel like the only person for miles around who hasn't given up, other than Anatole, who expresses his outrage in more productive ways. We sat without speaking a while after Elevé's announcement. The radio informed us the 2 American boxers would be paid $5 million each from our treasury for coming here, and it will cost that much again to provide high security and a festival air for the match. All the world will respect the name of Zaire, Mobutu declared in a brief taped interview at the end of the broadcast. Respect. I practically spat on the floor, which would have horrified Elizabeth more than the ill-considered use of $20 million. Do you know what's under the floor of that stadium? I asked. No, Elizabeth said firmly, though I'm sure she does know. Hundreds of political prisoners, shackled. It's one of Mobutu's most notorious dungeons, and we're all aware Anatole could end up there any day. For what he teaches, for his belief in genuine independence, for his loyalty to the secret Parti Lumumbist Unifié, he could be brought down by one well-bribed informant. The prisoners might make a lot of noise during the boxing match, Elevay suggested. Not improving the general respectability of Zaire, I said. Les Cambote, Elizabeth shrugged. Pascal and Patrice will be very excited. Mondelez, just think. Muhammad Ali, he is a hero. Little boys in the streets will cheer for him. No doubt, I said. People from the world over will come watch this great event, two black men knocking each other senseless for $5 million apiece. And they'll go away never knowing that in all of goddamn Zaire not one public employee outside the goddamned army has been paid in 2 years. For a woman to curse in Lingala is fairly abominable. Elizabeth puts up with a lot from me. Stanleyville, she commanded, to change the subject. Kisangani, I responded without enthusiasm. Elevay ran off to play with Pascal rather than be trapped into this drear exercise. Parc National Albert? Parc de la Maiko. Neither of us knew or cared if I was right. I'm learning that Elizabeth's sudden conversational turns are always for a good reason, usually someone's safety, probably mine. I watch her in the marketplace, too, well aware that no schoolroom has ever taught me as much. The Congolese have an extra sense. A social sense, I would call it. It's a way of knowing people at a glance, adding up the possibilities for exchange, and it's as necessary as breathing. Survival is a continuous negotiation, as you have to barter covertly for every service the government pretends to provide, but actually doesn't. How can I begin to describe the complexities of life here in a country whose leadership sets the standard for absolute corruption? You can't even have a post office box in Kinshasa. The day after you rent it, the postmaster may sell your box to a higher bidder who'll throw your mail in the street as he walks out the door. The postmaster would argue reasonably he's got no other way to support his family. His pay envelope arrives empty each week with an official printed statement about emergency economic measures. The same argument is made by telephone operators who'll place a call outside the country for you only after you specify the location in Kinshasa where you'll leave l'envelope containing your bribe. Same goes for the men who handle visas and passports. To an outsider, it looks like chaos. It isn't. It's negotiation, infinitely ordered and endless. As a white woman in Kinshasa, I present possibilities, but even a black woman with my same purse and leather shoes would be approached on the street. It's taking me forever to get used to this. Last week, a young man walked up and asked me outright for 3,000 Zaires, and once again, my jaw dropped. Mondelez, he wasn't asking for 3,000 Zaires, Elizabeth said quietly when we'd moved on to coveting the pineapples. He was opening the door for a transaction, she explained. He has something to offer, maybe inside information on black market goods or the name of a telephone operator with unauthorized, therefore cheap, access to long distance. She's explained this to me a dozen times, but it only sinks in as I come to see for myself what it is, this life. Anybody who needs anything in Kinshasa, a kidney stone operation or a postage stamp, has to bargain for it shrewdly. The Congolese are used to it and have developed 1,000 shortcuts. They sum up prospects by studying each other's clothing and disposition, and the bargaining process is well underway before they open their mouths to speak. If you're deaf to this subtle conversation, it comes as a shock when the opening bid seems to be, "Madam, I request from you 3,000 Zaires." I've heard foreign visitors complain that the Congolese are greedy, naive, and inefficient. They have no idea. The Congolese are skilled at survival and perceptive beyond belief, or else dead at an early age. Those are the choices. I got some inkling of this from Anatole long ago, I suppose, when he explained why he translated Father's sermons. It wasn't evangelism, just full disclosure. Opening up the bargaining table to a would-be congregation. I multiplied my perception of Anatole's intelligence by 10 that day, and now, looking back, I have to do the same for everyone we knew. The children who hounded us daily for money and food weren't dim-witted beggars. They were accustomed to the distribution of excess and couldn't fathom why we held ourselves apart. The chief who proposed to marry my sister surely didn't dream Father would actually hand over his whining termite. I think Tata Ndu was gently suggesting we'd become a burden to his village in a time of near famine. That people here accommodate such burdens by rearranging families, and that if we found such an idea impossible, we were perhaps better off somewhere else. Tata Ndu certainly had his arrogance in the ways of command, even calling down a vote in church to humiliate my father. But in matters of life and death, I can see now, he was almost incomprehensibly polite. It's a grief to see the best of Zairean genius and diplomacy spent on bare survival, while fortunes in diamonds and cobalt are slipped daily out from under our feet. This is not a poor nation, I remind my sons till they hear it in their sleep. It is only a nation of poor. No paycheck tonight, of course, let alone the supplementaire. But Anatole came home excited about the general strike and spoke of it quietly through dinner, careful as always to use code words and false names. Any such knowledge could endanger the boys. Though I believe Pearl Harbor itself would have passed by them tonight, intent as they were on devouring the manioc. To make it last longer, I pinched up little bites with my left hand while I nursed Martin on the right. With every gulp he drew, I felt more ravenous. One of these days, I announced, I'm going to take my bow and sneak through the bars of the Residence. Mobutu's Kinshasa mansion is surrounded by a park where some zebras and one pitiful elephant paw at the grass. Pascal was all for it. Oh, mama, abattons l'éléphant! Patrice soberly informed us he didn't think an arrow could pierce an elephant's hide. Pascal was unconcerned. Have you seen that thing? Mama's arrow will knock it over. Pluff! Couffoie! Elisabeth asked thoughtfully, Mondelet, how would you cook an elephant? What we eat is manioc, manioc, manioc. Whether it's tinted pink with a tomato skin or green with a leaf of cress, it's still manioc. Rice and soy meal help when we can get them to balance our amino acids and keep our muscle tissue from digesting itself in the process known picturesquely as kwashiorkor. When we first moved to Kalanga, I remember thinking the children must get plenty to eat because their bellies all bulged out. Now I know their abdominal muscles were too weak to hold their livers and intestines in place. I see signs of it in Patrice. Any food that reaches us in Kinshasa has to come over impossible roads in dilapidated trucks from the interior, so it costs too much even if you can find it. Sometimes Anatole reminds me of our long-ago conversation when I tried to explain how we grew food back home in huge fields far from the people who eat it. Now I understand his dismay. It's a bad idea, at least for Africa. This city is a foreigner's premise of efficiency planted on this soil, and it's a very bad idea. Living in it, no one could think otherwise. It's a vast congregation of hunger, infectious disease, and desperation masquerading as opportunity. We can't even grow any food of our own. I did try it right at the metal flank of our back door under the clothesline. Pascal and Patrice helped me scratch up a little plot that eventually produced a few bleak, dusty bouquets of spinach and beans, which were gobbled up one night by our neighbor's goat. The children of that household looked so starved, as did the goat, I couldn't regret this donation. We at least have the option of leaving. In the back of my mind, I think this. We could try again in Atlanta. And while we stay here for Anatole's teaching and organizing and live on the next to nothing that work earns, we still have a measure of privilege incomprehensible to our neighbors. I've taken my sons to the States for vaccinations that aren't available anywhere in Zaire. I've seen them all born alive and not one lost to smallpox or tuberculosis. We're luckier than most. That's what's hardest to bear, the view out the window. La Cité is a grim, dust-colored homeland, and I suffer nostalgia for our life in the interior. In Bikoki and Kelanga, we could always pick something off a tree, at least. We never passed a day without seeing flowers. Epidemics sometimes devastated the village, but they always ended, not far from where they began. I can have a good laugh at my former self, remembering how my sisters and I nervously made our list of prospects. Oranges, flour, even eggs. At our low point as missionaries, we were still fabulously wealthy by the standards of Kelanga. No wonder any household item we carelessly left on our porch quietly found a new home in the night. No wonder the neighbor women frowned in our doorway when we pulled out the linings of our pockets as evidence of our poverty. Not another soul in town even had pockets. They must have felt exactly as I do now, glaring at Mobutu on the doorstep of his fairy tale palaces, shrugging, with his two hands thrust deep into the glittering loot of his mines. I thought you said the Congolese don't believe in keeping riches to themselves, I told Anatole once, inclined toward an argument. But he just laughed. Who, Mobutu? He's not even African now. Well, what is he then? He is the one wife belonging to many white men. Anatole explained it this way. Like a princess in a story, Congo was born too rich for her own good and attracted attention far and wide from men who desire to rob her blind. The United States has now become the husband of Zaire's economy, and not a very nice one. Exploitive and condescending in the name of steering her clear of the moral decline inevitable to her nature. Oh, I understand that kind of marriage, all right, I said. I grew up witnessing one just like it. but it dawns on me now that in the end Mother carried every last one of our possessions outside as a farewell gift to Kilanga. There are wives, and then there are wives. My pagan mother alone among us understood redemption. The rest of us are growing into it, I suppose. God grants us long enough lives to punish ourselves. Janvier 17, mort de la Mumba, and Ruth May. That's still the bleak day at our house. Anatole and I grow wordless and stare into the distance at our own regrets, which aren't so far apart anymore. On January nights, I'm visited by desperate dreams of stretching myself out over the water, reaching for balance. When I look back at the shore, a row of eggs become faces of hungry children, and then comes the fall into blue despair, where I have to move a mountain that crumbles in my hands. It's a relief to wake up drenched in sweat and find Anatole's body next to me. But even his devotion can't keep this weight off my shoulders. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies, I catch myself praying before I've fully awakened to a world where I have no father and can count on no tender mercies. Anatole says recurring dreams are common to those who've suffered seriously from malaria. When I'm nervous or sad, I also fall prey to the awful itch from filaires, tiny parasites that crawl into your pores and cause a flare-up every so often. Africa has a thousand ways to get under your skin. Our life here in Kinshasa contains more mercies than most can hope for. I haven't yet had to bump off Mobutu's elephant. I even got to bring home a nice fat paycheck for a time. I signed on to an American payroll, rationalizing that I'd scatter dollars over the vendors in my little corner of La Cité, at least, as it's certain no foreign relief will reach them any other way. Mrs. Ngemba, English teacher, was my new identity. It chafed me as much as the Benedictine habit, as it turns out. I taught at a special school in the compound for Americans who came to work on the Inga-Shaba power line. This was a great nuptial gift from the U.S. to the Congo, financing the construction of the Inga-Shaba. It's an enormous power line stretching across 1,100 miles of jungle, connecting hydroelectric dams below Leopoldville to the distant southern mining regions of Shaba. The project brought in Purdue engineers, crews of Texas roughnecks, and their families who lived outside Leopoldville in a strange city called Little America. I rode the bus out there every morning to teach grammar and literature to the oddly unpoetic children of this endeavor. They were pale and displaced and complained of missing their dire-sounding TV shows, things with vice and cop and jeopardy in their titles. They'd probably leave the Congo never knowing they'd been utterly surrounded by vice, cops, and the pure snake-infested jeopardy of a jungle. The compound was like a prison, all pavement and block, enclosed by razor wire. And like any prisoners, these kids fought with anything sharp they could find. They mocked my style of dress and called me Mrs. Gumbo. I pitied them, despised them, and silently wheeled them back home on the first boat. I got warnings time and again for attitude, as the superintendent put it, but he tolerated me for want of a replacement. I quit at the end of the second term. The place spooked me. I'd step up onto the bus at my street corner at the end of 17 Janvier, doze bumpily through half an hour of pre-dawn, then open my eyes in another world. The compound had row after row of shining metal houses and dozens of liquor bars glittering at daybreak with an aura of fresh vomit and broken glass. The bus would hiss to a stop just inside the gate for a bizarre shift change. We teachers and maids would step down, and the bus would take on the weary, disheveled whores. Congolese girls with bleached orange hair and a crude phrase or two of English and the straps of expensive American bras sliding down their shoulders from under skimpy blouses. I could just imagine them getting home, folding this uniform, and wrapping themselves in paniers before going to the market. As we all stood blinking at each other, getting our bearings, the compound trucks would roar past us into the jungle, carrying crews of men who apparently, judging from the whores, never slept. In the course of a year, I watched these rough-and-ready foreigners go out to build thousands of miles of temporary roads for carting cable, machine tools, and sheet metal past villagers who live out their days without electricity, machine tools, or sheet metal. The Shaba province, incidentally, roars with waterfalls, more than enough to generate its own electricity. But with all the power coming from the capital, the mines could be lit up by Mobutu's own hand and shut down at the first sign of popular rebellion. Katanga had once tried to secede, after all. At the time I was working there, we believed that was the justification for this strange project. Since I quit, we've learned more, enough for me to curse my small contribution to the Inga-Shaba. It was not merely a misguided project. It was sinister. The power line was never meant to succeed at all. With no way to service a utility stretching across the heart of darkness, the engineers watched the monster's tail crumble as fast as the front was erected. The whole of it was eventually picked clean in the way a forest tree gets gleaned by leafcutter ants. Nuts, bolts, and anything that might serve for roofing material trailed off into the jungle. Anyone could have predicted that exact failure. But by loaning the Congo more than $1 billion for the power line, the World Export-Import Bank assured a permanent debt that we'll repay in cobalt and diamonds from now till the end of time. Or at least